Okay, welcome everybody. It's Thursday, May 13th, 12:45 now. And I was just getting started talking, realizing that I had not set a recording. So our last class meeting, and I wanted to talk about some of the things about this class that are different than the ways that we normally do things, or the way that I normally do things. The normal class, the way that it normally works, is the quizzes are all in class and timed, and usually 10 to 15 minutes. The exams are all in class and timed, and they're strict hour and a half in terms of the exams. And they're the exact same exams that I've been giving you. So I haven't changed or modified anything. And yet we've been doing everything in a take-home sort of format. The averages on the exams usually run, I would say, mid-70s to sort of high 70s would be the average on the exam when it's done in class. And it's done independently as an independent exercise. And there's oftentimes a lot of tears and a lot of anxiety and a lot of struggle. And what I generally talk about before the exams is the idea that I'm doing it to you on purpose, not because I'm being mean, not because I'm wanting you to struggle on purpose, but because I feel that it's important for you guys to be prepared for that next step in moving forward and moving on. And what happens at the university is something entirely different than happens at Cabrillo. What happens at the university is the instructors there are active in research and not active in teaching as much. They teach a lot, but generally they're active in research. And when they write an exam, they're writing an exam from what they're finding interesting and fascinating, and sometimes has no connection to what you've been doing in the class. And so you go in and you take that exam, and all of a sudden you sit down and you look at it and you realize, I don't know anything. I studied the entirely wrong stuff. I'm going to tank and fail this exam. And you've gone through Cabrillo and you may have a GPA that is like 3.87, 3.9, 4.0. And all of a sudden you're facing the first exam where you ever feel like you're actually failing something. And your whole world tanks and you think, I don't belong here at all. This is not where I'm supposed to be. I am just going to fail everything. And your mind starts to spiral and you may not even finish that exam. And you may not even turn it in. And it's the worst possible feeling ever. In reality, the average on that exam might be in the 40s. And the work that you were doing on that exam, while you feel like you were failing it, you might have actually been getting close to the high score on that exam. And the high score might have been a high 50. Or a low 60, and that might have been 20 points above average and might have been the high score. The point is that in order to get you ready for that, in order to get you mentally tough to stay in the game and to finish that exam, having some of that exam pressure on you is not a bad thing, so that you kind of get used to going in and having that sort of exam feeling of, oh my God, I don't know how I'm doing on this. All right, I just need to stay in the game. I just need to focus. I just need to get it done. And having it in a safe place where the exam averages still are coming out in the high 70s, mid 70s, and people are still scoring in the 80s. People are still scoring in the 90s. Some people, one or two people, may even still score 100 on that exam. And yet it gets you ready for that next level of what might be coming. That's something that I typically do on purpose, but didn't feel like it was a good place to do that in this type of environment. But I think it's important to talk about and for you to think about and be ready for, because as you transfer to the university, that's still not going to change. And as you transfer to the university, you're still going to be facing those types of classes and those types of expectations, and yet you are still ready for it. But you need to know that you're ready for it, and you need to know that that's a possibility, and you need to stay in the game when you're taking those types of exams and quizzes. Don't ever give up on an exam or a quiz. You have gone through a course here in organic chemistry where we've talked about not just the surface of things, but we've dug deep into the organic chemistry mechanisms. You've learned a way of thinking, of critical thinking, that is different than you're going to get from most classes. And it's going to allow you to be able to tackle problems which are tougher problems than most other students are trained to deal with. fall back on the skill sets that you know, analyze your options, look for stability, find the most stable thing. And it applies across all the different types of things that you'll look at, whether it's biology or chemistry or math or physics or whatever it is, the same skill sets apply. Stay in the game, finish those exams, and you're going to find that you're doing better than most of the native students that are in that environment, even though you're not feeling like it at the time. You've got to stay in it. Be a self-advocate. Advocate for yourself with the instructor. Make the time to go to the instructor's office hours, even if they're on Zoom and connecting. Send emails. Advocate for the time and for the accommodations and for the information that you need to be able to prepare for those exams and things. It's tougher at the university level. The instructors don't hold as many office hours. They're oftentimes really busy or on the phone when you come in. Just be patient and yet advocate for the things that you need. And by and large, you'll get them. But if you don't ask for them, you won't get them. And so be a good self-advocate. Find mentors that you can work with. So I think that finding a mentor is one of the most important things that people don't realize that they need or that can substantially help you. So finding those mentors, whether they be graduate students or whether they be the professors themselves, that finding those mentors is a really critical thing. And so how do you do that? Let me see, I'm reading a message from JC. You would think it'd be the other way around. It's not. The office hours that they're required to hold per their contract at the university are different than our contracts at community college. And we frequently hold many more office hours than they do at the university level. So at the university level, they may hold a couple of office hours a week, but not to the same degree that we hold at Cabrillo. So finding mentors is about finding those people who you connect with, who teach in a way that you respect and that you like, and reaching out to them. I think finding the mentors at the university level is also a little bit harder than finding it at the community college level. We tend to be a lot more approachable at the community college level, but there's some good ways to reach out and find mentors. And so one of the things that I recommend is that, particularly in chemistry and biology, in those areas, and physics to a large degree too, those three areas, the professors tend to have research groups. And the research groups tend to be fairly large. I mean, they can be three or four graduate students, and then there can be an additional, I would say, five or six undergraduates that are in those research groups. And if you go into a faculty member's office and you say, I'm really interested in your research, and I would like to join your research group, and is there a project that I can work on? They're going to tell you no. First off, they don't know you. Second of all, they have no trust in your ability to function in a lab or function in a research group setting. And they're almost always just going to flat out tell you no because it's too big a risk. And they have a dozen students every week coming in and asking them the same thing. So that doesn't work. What does work is to go into the research advisor's office. First off, go to the website and look at all the different faculty that are teaching in the area that you're interested in, whether it be chemistry, biology, physics, engineering, whatever it is. Look at the research that they do. Find two or three of them that you're interested in the research that they do. And then go to them, go to their office hours and ask them, you know, I'm really curious about your research group, and I'm wondering if you hold research group meetings and if they're open to undergraduate students, if undergraduate students can sit in and listen to those meetings. Okay, so now you're not asking to work in a lab. You're not asking for anything other than to come in and sit in and listen, and you've shown interest in them, which they love to talk about themselves. So all of a sudden, you've done a whole bunch of really right things, and they're like, yeah, that's a great idea. Why don't you come and sit in? And this is what our research group meetings are. And yeah, we're happy to have you show up, and you can sit in and listen all you want. They always say yes. They never say no. It's a perfect thing. Okay, so you go to the research group meeting and you sit and you listen. And it's a little awkward because you don't know what to expect. And maybe they're having a literature day and the graduate students have gone to the literature and they've found things in the literature that they're bringing in to presenting. Or maybe they're having a day where the graduate students are presenting their research, the actual things that they're working on, which is all really interesting. See if you can find some way to weave in a question or ask a question, or ask a question of a graduate student who's sitting next to you. Participate if you can a little bit. It's intimidating, and maybe not the first day, maybe the second meeting you go and you find some questions. And maybe you figure out what the schedule is by paying attention and when the next literature day is. And maybe you can ask, what research journals should I look at to find things to present? Maybe I could present one. Undergraduates do frequently present at these meetings. And pick something that's not so ambitious. Try to find an article and maybe try to present. And yeah, it's nerve-wracking. But all of a sudden, as you're participating, now you're part of the research group. And they invite you to come back to the graduate student office. And all of a sudden now you find out that all the undergraduates go into the graduate student office and they use the graduate students' desks when they're not there. And they ask the graduate students questions when they are there to help them with their assignments that they're working on in the advanced classes, be it chemistry or biology or whatever. And then you're sitting in these research group meetings and about 3 weeks go by and the graduate student looks over at you and says, how come you're not working on a project? I mean, you're just taking up space. Why aren't you doing something useful and working? And they invite you into the lab. And all of a sudden now you're working on a project because now they know who you are and they realize that you're not going away and that you're participating and that you're showing up all the time. And you never had to ask for it, but you earned a spot in the research group. And that's how you get there. That's the best way to get in. And it didn't require anything other than effort on your part and participation on your part and letting them get to see who you are and getting them to trust you by participating. That's the biggest thing. And it gives you so many advantages over all the other students, all right? Because what happens when you transfer to the university? One of the first things is that you find is you don't know where anything is. You have none of those safe places that you had at Cabrillo. At Cabrillo, you had the Mesa STEM Center. You had the Math Learning Center. Maybe you had the cafeteria, or you had some other places on campus that you hung out at, where you met your friends or where you could study, or special place in the library. And you don't have any of those places when you transfer. But getting into a research group this way gives you all of those places and gives you access to people who can help you with tutoring, gives you, yeah, for that whole one semester that you were there at Cabrillo. Sorry, JC. But it's not gonna last forever, right? This pandemic is gonna end. We are going back into session. And as you transfer and do those things, you are going to be back in person and you are going to be looking for these types of things. And that's what the research group gives you, is it gives you that home and that safe place on campus, that place to go, that place to drop your stuff, that place to go to for help, that place to have a feeling of belonging. That's another thing, is that sort of imposter syndrome, is that when you transfer to the university, that feeling of maybe I don't belong here just yet. And everybody here is smarter than I am. I guarantee you that is not true. And finding that research group and finding those places to go gives you those homes and makes you feel much, much better. It's an important thing to try to find, and to try to find it quickly once you get there, so that you can settle in and calm down. And I think the other thing is the pacing. That most of the schools that you're looking at transferring to are going to be quarter systems as opposed to semester systems. So one of the ways that you know that you're ready to transfer actually is when the quarter system just drags on and you're like, oh my God, this is killing me. Or you check out for a couple of days and you come back and the instructor is still on the same chapter and you're like, when is this chapter going to end? This chapter is going on forever. That's when you know that you're ready for the quarter system. And it's a bit of a culture shock that when you transfer and you get into that quarter system, it goes fast. And you miss a week and you feel like, oh my God, I'm dead. I am toast because now I'm three chapters behind and they just covered three chapters in that week. So when you hit that quarter system, you got to hit the ground running and you got to stay on top of it. And you've got to be organized and getting everything done and making those checklists every day. Sit down and make a checklist and cross the things off that you can and add to it the new things and just keep that checklist, rolling. But it's manageable. I think that you'll find that it's not that hard, that when you, if some of those things that I said about the semester system just rambling on forever are resonating with you, you'll find that the quarter system isn't that difficult, that the quarter system, while faster, you'll find that you're ready to keep up with it. And it's not so bad. And then that pacing starts to feel a little bit more normal after the first quarter. The first quarter is frantic. First quarter is quick. But then second quarter, much easier. And from then on, you're solid. Gosh, what other stuff can I tell you? These are all things from experience, having transferred from Cabrillo myself and having gone to UCSC and jumped into the quarter system. It's just, this is the way that I remember it. I think the other thing that I remember, which will probably take another semester or quarter or two before we get back into person, is going from Cabrillo, where you had classrooms where you had 25 students, 30 students, maybe 40 students was the largest classroom that you were kind of in. And all of a sudden finding yourself in a classroom with 300, 400 students and a professor who you need binoculars to see and who's using a microphone in order to reach out to the entire class. And that can be challenging because all of a sudden now you're not in that subtle little classroom where it's easy to ask questions. Now you're asking questions. Before you thought it was intimidating to ask questions in front of 20 people, 25 people. Now you're starting to ask questions in front of 300 people. It's like, oh my God, no way. I'm not asking that question. But I would challenge you and say, actually do sit in the front. Try to sit close and ask those questions and don't be afraid. Because I guarantee you that there's 200, 300 other students who aren't asking the question that have the same question that you do and are so thankful that you just asked that question. It's important. Keegan, my undergraduate degree was in chemistry. And does that get moderately better the more specific your classes get, JC? Yes, the answer is as you get into advanced classes, as you get into the upper division classes, then yes, the classrooms start going back to that 35, 40, or even smaller. I think my advanced organic chemistry class only had maybe 18, 16 people in it. So yes, as you get into the upper division classes, the classrooms get smaller. It's those lower division. I didn't do, when I was at Cabrillo, I didn't finish the physics series. I did my physics series at UCSC. And when I walked into that physics classroom, that was a 400 student classroom in the physics class. And it was okay. I handled it, but it was definitely different. It was definitely a shock. So yeah, that's important. And Keegan, in regards to my undergraduate degree, I started out looking at doing veterinary medicine is what I wanted to do. So I started out as a bio major and I found myself as a chemistry major, frankly, because I sucked at biology. And I never really got to where I wanted to get within biology. And I think it was, botany that was actually killing me. Botany and microbiology, because everything looked the same and there was so many terms to memorize and I don't memorize things well. And spelling is one of my hardest things ever. And I sucked at it. I can't tell you how many times I failed botany and zoology and just never got there. And for some reason, chemistry came easier. For some reason, as I was going through chemistry, I was getting better grades in chem and particularly in organic chemistry. And the farther I went in chemistry, it was weird. Most of the time, the farther you go, the harder it gets. The farther I went, the easier it got and the less studying I needed to do for some reason. And particularly within organic chemistry, I found that I really almost didn't need to study much. I just needed to listen. And so I went with what got easier for me. And everybody is different. That's different for everybody. I mean, some people sit down and they play piano and they've never had a lesson in their life and they hear a piece of music and they can just play it. And that's the way their brain works. And most of us aren't that way. I've been playing guitar since I was a teenager. I still suck at it. It's just, you know, sometimes we have our skill sets and we find that skill set and you go with what works. And sometimes it works out that way. So is it safe to assume that class sizes go down as you get further in undergraduate in general? Yes. The class sizes just go down the higher up in the classes that you go. That what winds up happening is that the upper division classes and the electives, people are going in different directions with their electives. And because there's so many different elective classes that you can take, that the general number of students that are in that elective, in that upper division elective, are much, much smaller than they are in the classes that everybody needs to take in those core classes. So yeah, when you look at, if you were to take organic chemistry or physics or some of the math classes, those are all big STEM classes and they maximize out the number of students that go in those and they have them in a 500 lecture hall. And that first class, you may have people that are sitting in the aisles, sitting on the stairs up and down, trying to get into that class. And then as that class goes on, it usually calms down and gets down to sort of like the 400 number as people drop and figure out to do other things. But then from there, as you go into advanced organic or advanced inorganic or some of the advanced math classes, if you're getting into advanced linear algebra or those types of things, all of a sudden now you're sitting more in something much more familiar to what you would see in Cabrillo. I think what else I want to tell you guys. I don't know. Any questions? It's different for sure, but it's exciting and it's really fun. And there's lots more things going on, lots of things of interest.
Any tips for graduate students?
Yes. Okay. So Joanne and I differ on this. Joanne Panzardi, some of you may know Joanne Panzardi if you've taken engineering classes, and some of you are engineering majors. Joanne is extremely active in helping her students decide where to go for undergraduate. And in fact, she got upset with me. She felt like I did not counsel one of our students enough and questioned where that student had chosen to go to the university. And my point is I tend not to get involved in a university choice. I think that a university choice, when somebody is choosing a university, that my recommendation is find the school where you are going to be most comfortable and where you can do your best work. Wherever you can do your best work, where you're going to feel safe and comfortable, that is where you're going to do well and your GPA is going to be the strongest and you're going to graduate and you're going to finish. And that's the most important thing. The name of the school for an undergraduate is not as important as the name of the school for graduate studies. And if you're going on to graduate work, the graduate school becomes a little bit more important in your choices of where you're going to go. And mainly it's not the name of the school, but it's the person that you want to work with and the person that you want to learn from. And so you're looking at the areas in which you want to study that are of interest to you, and you're finding professors at different universities. And then you go around and you interview with those professors and those research groups, and you're looking at those research groups where you want to get in. And the research group culture is extremely important. It's not enough just to understand sort of the professor themselves, but you'd like to understand the culture of the research group itself. And that's hard to get at, because when you go and you interview with a professor and you go and you interview with the graduate students who are already in the research group, they're going to tell you nothing but positive things. They're going to give you all this great information, which is going to make it look outstanding. And yes, this is the group that I want to be in. And you have no idea about the negatives. So how do you find out about the negatives about that research group and what the culture is like? You ask the neighboring research groups about the culture in that research group. you talk to graduate students who are in labs that are adjacent to it. Hey, tell me about so-and-so's research group. You know, what do graduate students, do they get out of there in 5 years? Do they get out of there in 4 years? What's the typical thing? What happens? What's the culture like in that group? Are they, do they fight a lot, or are they, you know, cohesive and cooperative? You got to do a bit more digging to sort of figure out the graduate school culture. And so I think graduate school choices are more important than the undergrad choices. And so typically most people who are going on in STEM, or most people who are going on in chemistry or biology, they're oftentimes going on to graduate school. And so I don't get too involved in the undergraduate decision, much more so in the graduate school decision in that regard. So graduate school is a different sort of thing. And there you've got to find, again, a place where you're going to be able to work and be happy and be comfortable. And I think in particular, that is really important in graduate school, because if you find that you need to change horses during graduate school, if you find that a research group is not working for you and you need to drop out of that group and you need to go find another group to work with for whatever reason, just because it's too incompatible, oftentimes those people don't finish their graduate degrees. Oftentimes they wind up dropping out of graduate school and taking the master's degree rather than completing the PhD. And it's because of personality issues and conflicts within the research group, either between the mentor and the student or between other graduate students and the student. And that's one of the main reasons that people will drop out in graduate school. So finding a good work environment, finding people that you can work with in graduate school is also important. Keegan, do I know a typical average time frame? It would be between bachelor's and PhD. You mean how long before you go getting your bachelor's degree to obtaining the PhD degree, or starting a PhD program after finishing bachelor's?
How long it would take from bachelor's to get a PhD?
That is different in every research group. And it is typically supposed to be 4 years. And it depends on the subject. But 4 years is what a PhD is supposed to be, is an additional 4 years. 2 years for the master and an additional 2 years for the PhD. And a typical PhD program, in your first year, you're taking classes, much like you would as an undergraduate. You're taking classes in areas that are areas for the PhD, but also when you go in to take or into a PhD program, they always do assessment exams. And if you have any deficiencies in those assessment exams, then sometimes they will require you to take remedial classes, meaning undergraduate classes in that area, in order to come up to steam in the graduate program. And so you may have a couple of additional classes that you may need to take upon entering that PhD program. In the first year, you also typically have what are called cumulative exams. This is true for biology and chemistry. Cumulative exams are exams that you need to pass a certain number of them. And when you are done passing that number, then you don't need to take them anymore. At UCSC, you needed to pass four and you had 12 attempts. And so, and what the cumulative exam is they typically give you a research topic and you go and study that topic in the current literature. So they don't give you any other direction than that generally. And you study that and then you come in and you take an exam, and it could be on any facet of area in that research. And then you need to pass that exam. At UCSC, the way they did it was they would have, I think, 6 or 8 professors give research topics. And each of those 6 or 8 professors would provide a list of maybe 6 to 8 research papers. and you needed to read all of those papers. And then when you came in to take the test, three of those professors will have written the test in their three areas that they gave you, and you needed to pass that test. And if you didn't pass it, then you just come back and you take the next one next month until you pass 12 of them. And if you don't pass 12, then they ask you to leave the program after the 12th one. But generally people were passing them, usually on their sixth exam, people were passing them and getting through. Some people went 8 or 9, but most people would fail the first two and then they would figure it out. In your second year, generally you are still taking classes, but you're starting to do some research. And in the second year, you generally have something similar to a literature talk that you need to give, a presentation that you need to give. And what they generally do is have the graduate student go and read a number of papers and then present to the entire department on those papers, not as if it was their research, but as if you were just presenting somebody else's research and going through and presenting this research topic as you're the expert on this topic and you're giving it. We called it second year seminar, is what we called it. And that's a little bit nerve-wracking because now you're giving a talk in front of the entire department, and it is all the professors and grad students of the department that you're giving that talk to. And at the end of that talk, they drill you to see how well you really understood the material. And sometimes you have to deal with personalities that are difficult. Sometimes what winds up happening is your professor has gotten into a fight with two other professors, and those two other professors then take it out on you by asking you all kinds of like stupid questions in front of everybody because they know that they can stick it to the other professor there by making you look bad. And so there's all these little things that wind up happening that are just academic games. But as long as you know that that's what you're going in for and you're kind of prepared for it and you know that it's not directed at you and don't take it personally, you'll survive just fine. It's just about keeping your composure. BB seems to respond to that. Happened to me too. So how do you gracefully say, I don't know? You say, that was beyond the research which I conducted. That seems outside the scope. I'm happy to take a guess at it, but that's really beyond what I looked into. And if you think you can do all right with it, take a shot at it, take a stab at it. It's not a bad thing to be wrong. It's all in how you deal with it. Then in your third year, you have orals. And orals are across all programs. Everybody sort of in their third year has orals. Orals are excruciating. Orals you prepare for almost an entire year. And orals are two components. Orals are generally, you're presenting your research to date, all the research that you've done, and you're presenting an original research proposal, which shows that you're ready to become a PhD and ready to take on that professor role and start your own research group. It shows that you have an original idea and that you have thought through that original idea and how you would originally conduct that research. It goes through the equipment that you're going to need to start the lab. It looks at the techniques that you're going to use to undertake that study. It looks at the actual chemistry that's involved and why you think that it's viable chemistry or interesting chemistry that's unique and original. And so you're not pulling this from the literature. You're actually taking and looking at the literature and coming up with an original idea and say, this is what I'm going to do. And it's never been done before. And this is how I'm going to investigate it. And I think this is what's going to happen. And this is what we're going to do. Your orals is done in front of a closed committee, usually consisting of four faculty members and an outside member, somebody from industry or academia at another school whom you invite to participate in that orals committee. And their job in the orals committee is to really find your weak points. They take you to the limit. Who was it that was asking? It was JC when you were asking, how do you gracefully say, I don't know? In orals, you don't get to gracefully say, I don't know. There is no gracefully, I don't know. In orals, they take you to that place where you are uncertain and unfamiliar, and they probe all of those areas and how you think on your feet and how you deal with it. And they look for all the raw spots, and they just pick at those raw spots like, it's just horrible. Or can be horrible, I should say. It depends on your personality and how you take it. If you understand that everybody there wants you to be successful, that their job is not to tank you, their job is not to try to kick you out. Their job is once again to see what your preparation is and how well you know it, and they want you to be successful. And sometimes even if you're struggling with something, if you listen closely enough, they'll give you hints as to how to find your way through that. And in particular, your research advisor is really there and wanting you to be successful. But in front of all those other faculty, they're not going to be able to save you. They're only going to be able to help you in the deliberations once you step out of the room. Because what happens is once you step out of the room, they all sit down and discuss whether or not you are a PhD candidate, whether or not they think that you have earned that PhD degree. And it really comes down to a lot, I think, about your PhD advisor feeling like you're going to be a good fit for that PhD and be able to be successful and in academia. Once you do that, then you advance to candidacy. And once you've advanced to candidacy, then there's only one more hurdle, and that is finishing your dissertation, finishing all the research that you need to finish, and writing the dissertation. So the fourth year is usually when you stop doing research, and now you're starting to write your dissertation, which is a BFD in itself. You write the dissertation, and then it gets submitted to the research committee, and the research committee reads it, reviews it, makes edits on it, maybe even asks you to go back and to make some new experiments in order to fill in some holes in that. And then once you're finished writing that dissertation and it's approved, you have an exit seminar, which is really more of a celebration. Some places, I guess the exit seminar could be a grilling, but most of the time it's more of a celebration and a completion of the PhD. And the thing that I didn't talk about was publications. Usually in your second year and your third year, the research that you've been working on in the research group is written up into several publications. And usually grad students will have at least 2 to maybe 5 or 7 publications. And those publications serve the foundation for the PhD dissertation. So you're not typically writing from scratch. You're typically taking all of this work that was done in these other publications and writing it into a dissertation. For mine, that was a little bit different because in my graduate school, I worked on a super double secret project. We were doing a glucose sensor for people who have diabetes to be an implantable glucose sensor that would detect sugar levels in the blood and be able to relay them out dynamically in real time. And the project was a patented project, and we had not patented it yet. And so nothing had been published. In fact, we were trying not to put things into publications and not have things go to meetings. And so at that time I had publications, but they were nothing to do with my dissertation. They were other projects that I had done a little bit of work on. And so none of that got to be used within my dissertation. My dissertation needed to be written from scratch. And it was excruciating because I just had to sit down and write it all at once. So there's different pathways through that. But back to Keegan's question, how long does it normally take? It's supposed to take 4 years. Within biology and chemistry, most of the time, because of the research that's being done and the publications that they want you to write, instead of having a time limit in years, most professors will say, I like you to have 3 publications before you can write your dissertation, or I like you to have 4 publications. Hit those 4 publications and then you can write your dissertation. And so what you find is oftentimes people will go year 5, year 6, and they'll finish year 6, sometimes even year 7. and it can be a 7-year sort of PhD thing. A little note on that, one of the research groups next to me was Konopelsky's research group, and Konopelsky was in total synthesis. And so his students were oftentimes 6 and 7 year students in the PhD program. One of his students, a woman who was a good friend of mine, she hit middle of year 4 and she went to Konopelsky and she said, I'm done. I'm going to write my dissertation. And he says, oh, no, no, no. We have a lot more work to do. You have all this to do and there's no way. And she said, I am done and I'm going to write my dissertation. And she did. And she was done in 4 years and she was out and she was working in industry. And she just told him the way it was going to be. She didn't allow him to tell her what she needed to do. She just decided, no, I'm done. I'm writing and I'm out. And her dissertation committee backed her. And so sometimes how long it takes you to get out is not getting trapped into the idea that you need to complete a certain amount of work, but that you put in the time, you put in the classes, you put in the research, you're writing it and you're writing it on your schedule and you're getting done and having that mental toughness to say, this is it, this is what I'm doing.
Jason, on like schedule notes, because I know you're like writing your dissertation kind of coincided with your like first kid being born. Yeah. So for you, like I know I want to start a family probably around like 26 or 27, pretty young. And so like, how do you, I don't know, like how was it, I guess it's my question.
Yeah. It wasn't my first kid, it was my second kid when I was writing the dissertation. But yeah, my first daughter was born, I think, in my second year in grad school. And my second child was born in that fourth year. And I was writing my dissertation over the fifth year while I was also teaching at Cabrillo full time. And it was a lot harder having a family and going to grad school. But I would say that most of the grad students had kids. And so it was not uncommon. It was more common than not for grad students to have kids and to do that. I think that was what was a good lesson that I learned in that regard is that I lived off campus and I was up in Scotts Valley and commuting to UCSC. And that there were many, many nights where I was working all night long. In the project that I was working, it was my regular schedule to work every Wednesday, to work all night long, and then to have a presentation on Thursday to the people who were our financial backers, and then to go home and crash. And that was a challenging schedule to keep. And also as a graduate students very rarely keep normal business hours. It's sort of like it's all work all the time. And the lab has its own schedule. You start experiments and those experiments need to be terminated and at a certain time, or the experiment goes wrong, goes bad, and the results are not trustworthy. And so you frequently find that you may start something in the morning and you may start something in the afternoon and you need to go back at 10, 11 o'clock at night to shut it down and to work it up. And you may be working for a couple of hours. And so if you're living far away from campus, then you have the added commute time in that. And if you have a family at the same time, then that gets very challenging. But if you look into something more like graduate student housing, where you can have a family on campus and live closer, then it's an easy walk to the lab. And it makes all of that timing a whole lot easier. It makes family life a whole lot better. So if starting a family is something that you're really interested in, I certainly wouldn't say don't do it. But I would say consider the time constraints that grad school is going to place on you and think about your living situation and how you can maximize your time with family and also get the work done. And on campus housing, family student housing is one of the best opportunities there. It's a great,
and like, great
question.
I know that they're funded too. So like, I guess you get paid. So was it like enough is kind of another question. Like, was it like genuinely enough?
Yeah, it actually was. BB's going to kill us right here. so many different areas of campus, you know, they have graduate students, and graduate students are generally, there's a great comic. If you're interested in what grad school is like, PhD comics. If you look up PhD comics and you read PhD comic, it is grad school to a T, particularly in chemistry and biochemistry. And it is the funniest thing you ever read. And having gone through graduate school and lived it, and then to read that comic, it looks like it's ridiculous. And like, that can't possibly be true. And you're like, oh my God, that was my life. and it's you're both crying and reading it and laughing at the same time because it's hysterical. I love that comic. But shoot, I forgot where I was going with that question. Ask me one more time. Now I totally lost the thread.
I was just asking if, like, you know, because they're funded and they
So the funding part is different. There's two ways to be financially supported in grad school. When you say they pay you, they only pay you under two ways. One is to be a research associate to work in for your professor, and the grant that is supporting the research pays your research stipend and pays you X amount of dollars each quarter, which they break up into a monthly paycheck. And the other way that they pay you is to be a teaching associate. And there you're a TA and you're working in the labs generally, or sometimes you're working as a lecture TA where you're doing discussion sections. And there the graduate school is actually paying you as a teacher to teach those sections. And so they pay your tuition, and on top of your tuition, they also pay you the extra wage that would come out of that, which was a livable wage when I was doing that. So yes. And for chemistry and biochemistry, I don't know about engineering and the other areas. For chemistry and biochemistry, because they have so many different labs that need to be taught, you're either on a teaching associate or a research associate. You're on one or the other. And it really depends upon whether or not your PhD advisor has enough money to be able to pay you as a research associate. And otherwise, then you apply for the teaching associate. And as long as you have good teaching evaluations, you can fund yourself entirely through the teaching associate. It means that you're doing more teaching. It means that if you can get on a research associate, it's like doing double duty, because you need to do your research to get your PhD done, but you're getting paid to do that research, which is awesome. If you're on a teaching associate, then you also need to get the research done. And so now you're doing teaching in addition to trying to do your research. But it's available to you. If you look at people who are getting a history PhD or an English PhD or an art PhD, those labs are far and few between. Those discussion sections, there's only a few of them. And so only a couple of those students are able to get those types of fundings, and they need to find other ways to get out of school without having a tremendous amount of debt. And so, so yes, within chemistry, that's doable, which is kind of cool. Yeah, and you can find external grants, BB, that's a good point. You can find external grants and scholarships too if you search sometimes. And what I would say is not just search, but if you're diligent and you apply to a ton of them, just shotgun approach. If you spend your time finding those grants and finding those scholarships and apply to as many of them as you can apply to, and you have letters of recommendation from your instructors, your research advisor, and you just spend a good amount of effort doing that, you can rake in some serious money to support yourself. It can be really helpful. And so where do you find those types of things? The grants and scholarships, there's always a scholarship and grants office. Particularly in scholarship office, you can go and you can find lists of scholarship that the school has, and you can find ones that will fit with you. For grants, the grants are a little bit different. The grants are generally more in the domain of the research advisor, and the research advisor knowing sort of what grants are out there and available and fit with your with the type of research that you're doing. And learning how to write grants is an extraordinarily valuable skill set. It's not easy. So finding a research advisor who is going to teach you how to grant write is really important. I didn't get that in grad school because we were working on this thing that was being paid for by a company. I never had to write a grant in grad school. So I didn't get that in grad school. But what I did is when I was at Cabrillo, in my last year at Cabrillo, the organic chemistry instructor at Cabrillo, Harry Unger, was writing a grant to the National Science Foundation to get money to produce three-dimensional graphical images, animations, to teach organic chemistry. And he had a couple of us, two of us in particular, myself and a friend of mine named Albion, and Albion and I helped him to write that grant. And then when we got declined, we wrote it again and we figured out how to write that grant. And the second time it was awarded, and I was no longer at Cabrillo, but we got the grant awarded. And Harry and I wrote two more grants after that while I was in grad school. And then when I came back and taught at Cabrillo after grad school, I actually took over being PI on one of those grants. And so I got my grant writing experience from Harry Unger from Cabrillo and going through and learning how to do that. And that school, that skill is invaluable. That's an incredibly important one. So yeah. This is a lot about grad school stuff, which is all good.
Sorry.
No, it's perfect. I don't feel like you're directing that, BB. I think Keegan was asking, I think others have the same sort of questions of, you know, grad school is only 2 years away. If you think about it, if you're transferring to the university, it's time to start thinking about what it is you want to do and where you want to go. And that's right, it's Keegan's fault. This is an appropriate conversation to have too. You don't want to start thinking about graduate school when you've already graduated or when, you know, in that last quarter. You want to start thinking about graduate school now and where it is you want to go and what you want to do and where you want to be. It's important to have that sort of long range plan in mind and where you want that to go. No, that's not true, Bibi. Yeah. So I think these are all important things. Ah, and one more thing that I'm thinking about now too is lab skills. Lab skills are so important. I mean, for me, the lecture is something that I love and the material I love, but the lab skills is one of the things that I pride myself on in terms of the skills that you guys get out, in terms of what I can actually teach you in the lab and showing you how to work with equipment and showing you how to work with your hands and showing you how to do things that you don't generally learn until you're a grad student. And in fact, most of the time you guys come out with skills that surpass grad students and that you can do things that a lot of grad students don't even know you can do. Most instructors, I think all instructors are going to have to realize that as you go forward, you're not going to have those lab skills. And there's just no substitute for that. There's no substitute for walking into a lab and learning how to work with your hands and how to work with dangerous chemicals and how to walk that line. And it's a really important line. If you're afraid of the materials, if you're afraid to work with the hazards, you're going to get hurt. Because when you're too afraid of things, you're going to make mistakes because that anxiety is always there and that fear is always there. And you're not going to be able to move forward when it's important to move forward. And you're not going to be able to make good decisions because you're going to be too scared all the time. On the flip side of that, if you're not careful with what you're working with, if you don't have respect for the materials that you're working with, you can get equally, if not worse, hurt in the accidents that can happen on that side. There's a very, very important line that you need to walk, which is right down the middle of having respect for the materials, but not being afraid of the materials. And so it's important to keep that in mind when you're working with dangerous things. Keep respect. Try not to be afraid of what you're working with. And not being afraid means knowing what to do in an emergency, knowing how to handle yourself when things go wrong, and making plans for what could go wrong. Just as we do within the lecture, when we sit down and we say, all right, we have a diene, and I'm going to protonate it, and I'm going to get 4 carbocations, and figuring out which of those carbocations is the most stable carbocation. You've gone through your options, you've figured out your options, and you found the best case, right? Think about those other options as being bad outcomes. In a laboratory sense, you want to think through all those bad outcomes and what to do in case those bad outcomes happen. And in some cases, that means having a quench solution nearby, having a safety solution nearby, making sure that you're wearing your eyeglasses, the right gloves, having, if this spills, I don't have my electronics next to it, right? I have my electronics up out of the way, out of someplace else. It's taking those precautions and doing all those things that you need to do to stay safe and thinking through all of those things. So in addition to that, you guys are going to have to be vocal and self-advocate and remind the people that you're working with that you haven't had the opportunity to learn how to do all of those things and that you're going to need some instruction. Not that you're, you've been shirking and that you haven't taken advantage to have those types of experiences, but those experiences have not been available to you because of the pandemic. And so I think it's just really important to be clear with the people that you're working with and to remind them, I don't have that skill set. Can you help me to show me how to do this so that I can do it safely? I think is probably the best phrasing. And that is actually going to earn you a tremendous amount of respect to stand up and to say, this is where I need help. Teach me so that I can do this safely, and then I can take it from there. And that when you get stuck and you don't feel safe, to say something, not to just go ahead and say, I need to prove myself, and so I'm going to figure out my way through this. It is a far better thing to say, hey, I need some help here in moving forward to be able to do it safely, and to ask for that help. And I think that you're going to find that that's going to go much better, and that you will get those lab experiences, that there's lots of places yet as we move forward within biochemistry and biology and attempting to get into a research group, that there are lots of opportunities yet to earn those skills, and that I don't think you're going to be at that much of a deficit, or at least let's put it this way, you're not going to be at a deficit compared to everybody else around you. Everybody at that level is going to be in the same boat. They have all gone through these classes and not had an active lab experience. And so I think that's going to be okay. As long as you guys are vocal about it. What else? Any other questions come up? Any anxieties about transferring? I'm sort of watching the chat, make sure I didn't miss anything. Any med school direction? I have less experience with med school. But what I will say is that when I first started teaching OCHEM, 80% of the students were pre-med. And I had maybe another, if 80% were pre-med, then another 17% were biochemistry or biology. And about 3% were chem students, which means that I usually had one chem major in the class, was all it was. As time has gone on, that's changed. And I would say that pre-med, that probably I've still got a good number of pre-med students that are in the class. I've got way more chemistry majors. I've got a ton of biology majors. I've got some engineering. I've got people who go into veterinary medicine. I've got people who go a lot of different directions. And that what they find coming out of the class is, because of the way that we have looked at problems and thought about problems, that you're well prepared for med school and the types of things that they are going to throw at you at med school. Particularly that SN1, SN2, E1, E2 chapter that you would have done in Zaruba's class. That chapter, more than anything, sort of symbolizes the skill sets that they want in med school. And it's a skill set where you have to memorize a lot of different factors and juggle a lot of different factors and all the things that are coming in. You need to sort of decide which direction it's going to go. And there's no hierarchy, so it's not like a checklist and just hit X, Y, Z, done, it's this thing. No, it's like, oh, but which one of these is weighted more? And nope, I'm under this. And so these conditions tell me that this one is weighted more now. And so it takes me over here. And it's being able to juggle all of those types of things. And I think that this class and the curriculum actually does a really good job of preparing you for the types of things that you're going to face in med school. So in terms of advice or med school direction tips, one of the big things is the MCATs and taking the MCAT exam. The MCAT exam is a lot like taking the ACS standardized exam. There are preparation books for the MCAT exam that you can get. I would say definitely get a hold of the preparation materials for the MCATs and set yourself a schedule. Treat it like a class. Say that I'm going to get through this much material each day or each week. And as you're going through and taking your other classes, make time and study time for that material and hit that material hard. And then don't be afraid to reach out to other instructors, past and present, to help identify questions or problems that you may be having in that preparation materials. And that in and of itself will give you a huge leg up in taking that MCATs and scoring the type of exam score that you need to score in getting into med school. And then of course it comes down to your grades and letters of recommendation. Right? And letters of recommendation are key. I don't know who on campus writes more letters of recommendation than I do. In fact, I don't think anybody does. Joanne, maybe. Joanne and I might be tied. I don't know. But I write a ton of them. I mean, that's one of the things that I do more than almost anything else is write letters of recommendation. And I have people coming back to me for letters of recommendation for graduate school. Once they've finished undergrad and they come back for graduate school. And then even after graduate school, I've had people that are going for new jobs and doing things that come back to me and want letters of recommendation. And I'm not opposed to doing that, and I do it. But one of the things that I will say is that as you move forward, as you go higher up, it's important to have recency with those letters of recommendation. So I'm a great source for writing a letter of recommendation, for getting into an internship, for maybe even helping getting into a research group, for getting into graduate school, because I'm part of your undergraduate experience. But once you get into graduate school, it's finding those graduate school mentors that can write you those letters of recommendation that are much better, and making new connections there. And sometimes that's hard, and you want to go back, and I can write you a great letter of recommendation, but in the eyes of the person reading it, it's about recency. And there comes questions that if you're in graduate school and you're reaching back to your undergraduate community college instructor in organic chemistry to write you a letter of recommendation, no matter how glowing it is, there's a question of why do they have to go all the way back to that person for that letter of rec, right? And so, JC, great question. Never asked for a letter of recommendation. So how do you ask for one, and how do teachers like to be asked for one? That is a fantastic question. With me, what I do is students will contact me and say, I am writing or I'm applying to a summer internship and I need a letter of recommendation. Is this something that you can do for me? And I, of course, say yes. And then I say, all right, number one, tell me what the deadline is. Number two, point me to the direction of that internship and let me look at it and see what it is that you're applying for. And I read what it is that they're looking for in the student and what type of internship it is. And I tailor the letter for that. I may come back to you and ask you for information that is outside of what I know about you. I may come back and ask you things like, do you have any community involvement that you've done? Is there any volunteering work that you've done? Is there, what jobs have you held? For instance, if people are applying to med school, then I want to know about all those volunteer positions that you've done, that maybe you volunteered at Dominican, maybe you volunteered at different places, or maybe you've worked in a dentist shop and you've done work there. And I want to hit all of those types of things that I can for you that do both. You're going to hit them and they're already going to be in your application. But when I hit them, then all of a sudden it shows, hey, this guy really knows that student, and this guy's, the information that this guy's telling me can be trusted and is important, and it makes a bigger impact. And so helping your letter writer to understand what it is you're applying for, what it is you think they're looking for, and what information you have or you have done that can help in that letter to support that application is really, really helpful to us in writing those letters. And like I said, I write letters for all kinds of things. They can be internships, scholarships, job applications, graduate school applications, medical school applications. And every single one of those, I write in a different way. And a lot of students want a general letter of recommendation and go to a professor and say, can you write me a general letter of recommendation? To which I always say, no, I'm not writing you a general letter of recommendation. That's worthless, because the general letter of recommendation doesn't target what it is you're trying to achieve. And so for me, I don't care if you come back to me 12 times. And I have some of them. If I show you some of the files that I've got, I have some people, I've written 25, 30 letters of recommendation for different things. And one guy, it was different letters of recommendation for all kinds of different programs that they were going for. And they required me to slightly turn that letter around and change it for the different types of programs that they were going for. But that's what was needed, right? In order to make it viable. So I don't like to be asked to write a general letter. And every letter that I write, I try to address it to the company or the internship or the fellowship or whatever it is, wherever that letter's going. I like that letter to be addressed properly. And I like to hit the name of the organization or whatever it is in that letter that says this letter was written just for this and is important. So that's important to me. So I write a lot of those. And I wouldn't hesitate to write a letter for any one of you. So that door is always open if you need that. So asking in person, going into office hours is a great way to do it. Getting some FaceTime with them, particularly if it's been some time. Although if it's been some time, sometimes finding the ability to go into office hours is hard. I've had students who have come back to Cabrillo and they've been back on a family trip and they take the opportunity to come in and stop by my office. And they don't care if it's office hours or not. They just bang on the door and say, hey, remember me? And because I'm staring at them, of course I remember them. Whereas on an email and a name, I might recognize the name, but I might have a harder time putting the face to it if it's been a while. And so trying to get some FaceTime with the instructor and going in and asking in person is a great way. Absence that, sending an email and giving them a little bit of detail. If you did something in their class that may remind them of who you are, maybe bringing that back up in that email just to remind them is a great way to do it. But just about any professor would be willing to write letters. What I will say is that some professors are better at it than others. And don't be afraid to ask, because that's part of our job.
Any tips on having to write your own reference letter?
Oh.
Because I have old professors, both in time-wise, but also they're like 85 from undergrad, who don't write reference letters, but they make you write your own reference letter that they sign.
That is chintzy. God, I should start doing that. That's a great idea. Think of how much less work I'd have to do. That's great, BB. Thanks for that.
That wasn't supposed to be a tip.
BB, that's hard. That's really hard. Depending upon what it is that I'm trying to write the letter for, I have a formulaic way that I like to write that doesn't look formulaic. In other words, my first paragraph is introducing my relationship to the student, the class that was taken, and a little bit about the class and the expectations that were placed on the student in the class. The second paragraph usually revolves around the student's achievements within the class, a little bit about their achievements, their grades, the way that they interact within the class, types of questions that they might ask, these types of things that show that they're a good student in lecture. My third paragraph is generally about lab and the way that they function within lab, how they handle themselves in the lab, their attention to detail, their way of working with instrumentation, the respect that they have within the lab, their written and oral communication. I'll hit that in there as well. And then my fourth paragraph is sort of a summary, a summing up. It talks more about the personal traits of the individual, about their professionalism, about their ability to contribute, to make significant contributions. And then my advocation for including them in or selecting them for that internship or that job or whatever it is. And that's the way that I sort of go about and do that. And like I said, I tailor it. So I had one that I wrote just, I think it was 2 days ago, for a woman who is now applying for an internship in a forensics lab with the Department of Defense. And she'll be doing, if she gets the internship, she'll be working in military forensics, in working with both police, but also military applications of everything from bomb signatures and bomb making materials to analyzing explosions and byproducts that come out of things. And just, I don't know, think about military applications and forensics in the world is off the charts of really cool things that she could be working with. And so that letter had to be a different sort of letter. And while I used the same formula, what I focused on more was her lab skills and her ability to function in a lab and to work with instrumentation and to do that type of thing and her creativity and intellect and way of looking at problems that would be a better fit for that type of thing. So within those paragraphs, I will hone in detail and then re-hit in that summary some of those main important things that make them a really good fit for that job or internship or whatever it is. So that's the kind of formula that I use for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, great question. You know, now that we're doing this, I'm thinking that this is something that I really should find time to do more often rather than just in the last class. That these types of conversations are really an important part of figuring out where you're going and figuring out how to operate in things. And it's part of that mentoring job that happens from mentors, but doesn't oftentimes happen in the class format because we're so dedicated on working on the course material that none of these other things really have a place where we get to talk about them very much. And yet they're critically important. I'd say that they're more important than some of the information that we're dealing with in the class, just because this is how you survive in an academic world and how you fund things, how you figure out how to function with families, how you get letters of recommendation, how you're able to advocate for yourself and move forward. How do you find a mentor? How do you find homes within academic environments? All of those things that are the things that make students successful. And they're not traits that are inherently there or that we just automatically know how to do, unless you have a family member who has gone through academics and who has a PhD and who does that. There's nobody to teach you these things. It's just learned by trial and error. And so finding, and this is why mentoring is so important, is because the academic world is different. And it's challenging. And when there's nobody to teach you how to do things or to be able to ask for help, you're left struggling. And that's when we start to fall off the charts and fall off the radar and drop out. And yet when somebody shows you the way and shows you how to do these things, then all of a sudden it's not so scary or hard. And you start to figure it out and it becomes easy and it becomes second nature and you become more comfortable and you become more successful. And that's why mentoring is also important. And I think the other part is seeing a mentor, finding mentors who aren't just helpful, but also help you to see yourself in that position. Finding mentors who you connect with, whom you can see and say, that's where I want to be, and they got there, and I can see myself getting there. So finding mentors that look like you, that can help to make it tangible, to be able to reach that position. And you all can. Having come from community college myself, I know all of you can. And when I say I come from community college, I don't just mean I come from community college. I don't just mean that I come from Cabrillo. Sterling knows the answer to this question, I think. I don't know if anybody else here does. Want to take a guess at how many community colleges I attended? BB knows. 4 different community colleges. I didn't just go to one community college. I went to 4 community colleges. I started out at Laney College in Oakland. I got passed from swim coach to swim coach. I got passed from my high school swim coach to my college swim coach at Laney College. And I flunked everything because I didn't know how to have a grade, how to study, how to do anything. I went to chemistry class, sat in chemistry class, watched some big, tall, white guy who had to be like 6'8" in a lab coat, teach organic chemistry, general chemistry, wasn't organic, general chemistry. And I didn't understand a word he said. He spoke perfect English, but I didn't understand a word that he said. I failed that class so bad. Math class, algebra, trig, failed. I failed everything. So many stories. And then I did a little stint at Merritt College in Oakland. I did a stint at Butte College up in Chico. And each time I transferred from community college to community college, I just ditched the old record. There was nothing to pull forward with me. There was nothing that I passed. There was no credits to take forward. It was just a bunch of failures. And at Butte College, I actually passed some things. I actually passed chemistry. I passed math. I passed a few things. I figured out how to study better. And then I dropped off the radar again. And I started back in working construction. And I went back to work as a hob carrier. A hob carrier is the guy that mixes cement for the people who lay bricks and stone and block. And I worked as a hob carrier for years. And then I finally went back to Cabrillo because I realized that in the economic downturn in the mid-90s, I started working over the hill in San Jose as a hob carrier on a big industrial job. And there it was hot and they just yell at you, and block is really heavy. And I'm not a small guy, but I'm not a big guy either. And carrying block all day long was killing me. And with just people yelling at me all day long, I just didn't have the time for that. And so going back to school seemed like a really, really good idea at that point. And there was some really strong, some really good reasons to do well, finally, to figure out how things work. And so things started clicking much better at Cabrillo. And so I'm a firm believer too that school and education happens when a person is ready for it. And that happens at different times and at different ages for different people. And so never be worried about how old you are, how late in the game you are, or where you're at, because it happens for different people at different times. And you're never precluded from making it to where you want to be, that those opportunities are always there. You just have to put in the work. That's all it comes down to. So I know you all can make it, because I know the struggles that I had, and I know where I'm at, and I know the road is a viable road. Okay. All right. It is 2:05. I'm looking at the clock. I've been talking for a good long time now. I didn't really review anything, but we're going to review some in lab this afternoon. We reviewed in lecture in lab this morning. So we'll hit that lab review this afternoon. We'll do the same thing. I'll put the final exam up, not Friday, maybe Saturday, maybe Friday. Maybe I can get it up Friday night. It'll be available Friday night. it'll be available. I think the best thing to do is make it available through Thursday. Obviously, there'll be some flexibility there, but the sooner you can get it in, the sooner I can get it graded and I can move forward on everything. In the meantime, I'll move through and I'll grade all the other stuff that is sitting there, the co-ops and things. As I said, I'll throw points at everybody for co-op 4 because we did co-op 4 as a group together in labs. So I'm just going to throw full credit at co-op 4 at you through Canvas. So don't worry about turning that in. The lab thing, I will also get graded. People are concerned about the lab grade. Don't be. Lab grade's going to be fine. What I told people this morning was that I'm only doing that one lab report, and no, your entire grade does not hinge on that one lab report. What we've been doing and working every day and all the participation that you guys have had in lab, I value participation more than I value anything else. And you guys have been there with me every single day and done everything I've asked you to do. So in that, huge props and huge respect for sticking it out and being there with me every day on Zoom, because I know that's not easy in and of itself. So you guys are awesome. Yeah, I'll get the second lab videos up because I'm going to need them for next semester. So you guys, I'll tell you what, I'll put out an email to everybody when I get those up eventually. And you can go and watch those and see how fun those were, because those are actually going to be, they're actually going to be nice videos. I think I was getting better as I was going through and doing those videos. So I think they'll come out pretty good as I go through and do those. And I'll try and get some more up too. If I get more up than that, then I'll put those up. I'll let you guys know when those go up too. As far as, oh, this is important though. As far as the website, I will keep the website and the videos and all of the materials up archived for at least a semester, if not two. So they'll be available through the summer and through next semester, and you can go back and you can review any of the materials. I don't make it through all of the materials that I would like to make it through. And because of that, what I'm also going to do is put up some things for people. Where are they? Chem 12, all lecture study guides. I have notes for chapters that we didn't cover, such as enolate chemistry. And I have all the notes on the enolate chapter that I'll make available. I have the carbohydrate chapter for those people who are going into biochemistry and need the carbohydrate chapter. I have all my handwritten notes out for that. I have the same thing for the amines and for peptide synthesis and all of that cool stuff. And I will put those up online in there underneath today's lecture as well. So I'll put those resources available for you guys so you can download those And then when you get into biochemistry or you get into other biology classes and you need to review either amines or peptides or those types of things or carbohydrates, you can go back to those notes and you can pull down those notes and review those. And that'll be a more concise, easy way to kind of get the information that you need. So I'll make those available to you as well. And other than that, it's been a fantastic class. You guys have been fantastic. And I really just so much appreciate your sticking with it through all of this Zoom online class. I know it's not the easiest format, but you guys have done a really, really awesome job. And I'm really proud of all of you. All right. So hang in there, hang tight. Make sure that you get all the stuff done for your other classes that you need to get done as well. Don't hesitate to ask for help if you need it. If you need office hours or you need to talk during finals week, shoot me an email and I'll find the time to jump online and support you. And we can have a Zoom conversation if we need to. Okay. Oh, JC asked, is the exam going to be just new stuff or are you going to make some of it cumulative? I don't know. That's a good question. I'll look back and see what I did. I think that what I did was I just made it the last chapter the last time rather than making it a whole cumulative exam. Typically I do 50% old stuff and then 50% new stuff and split the exam kind of into two parts. That's another way that I oftentimes do it. I'll look and see what makes sense. And I'll give you a heads up. I'm trying to remember what I did last semester. And I have a sense that last semester, maybe I just did the new stuff, but I don't want to commit because now I can't remember what I did. I want to be consistent. So I want to look back at it. I'll let you know. I'll send out an email and let you know. Okay. All right, you guys. Thank you. It's been fun. Take care. Stay safe. Be well. I'll see the afternoon group at 3:00.
Thanks, Jason.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
What do you got, Sterling?
Oh, I was just going to ask when a convenient time for the ACS is, Jason.
When are you coming back?
Complicated question. I am physically present May 22nd. I am physically available June 1st. but I have like all summer. It's not like, you know, I have a time I need to take it, but I've been slowly going through the studying and kind of just like really going through everything. And yeah.
Okay. So what I would like to do, I'm teaching all summer, so I'll be available all summer. It's something that we kind of need to do in person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm excited to meet you in person.
Yeah. And we can, and I will get permission to be able to administer that exam at Cabrillo, but I'd like to make it early enough that, that if we need to take it a second time, that we can give you a little bit more time to prepare and take it a second time. And then we need to have enough time to communicate it to Berkeley as well.
Yeah.
So Berkeley needs that, before you choose and enroll in classes, right?
Yeah. I would imagine they do, but I would also imagine that it doesn't matter too much before that because they actually have the option of taking it at Berkeley like the week before classes start.
Oh, okay.
So I'm sure like we could, but I still want to take it at Cabrillo, but yeah. So, but I'm sure like we don't have to worry too much. I figure just make it easy for you. Like right when classes start for summer, probably like June 20th.
Okay.
Yeah. Does that work?
Sure.
Okay, cool. So I'll just like shoot for around then.
Yeah.
That's so cool, Sterling.
What's up?
I'm just really happy for you.
I'm really excited. I haven't been able to like stop doing like somersaults in my mind.
That's a big thing, dude. I mean, we send maybe, we send maybe one every other year, two every other years. So that I have the student that right now that I was saying that is applying to the Department of Defense forensic, she's coming out of Berkeley and she transferred to Berkeley. And she was the last one that I had to write this letter for. And so that was 2 years ago, but I've had, over the years, I've had 6, 7, 8 students go to UC Berkeley.
The imposter syndrome is really real.
And the thing to remember about Berkeley is that the environment is different. It's different than Cabrillo, and the mentality is different. And so you have to gear up a little bit for that mentality. Maybe Kimmy is her name. Maybe I should put you in touch with Kimmy. Maybe you can shoot Kimmy questions.
That'd be cool. Yeah.
Maybe I can introduce you guys over email.
Yeah, that'd be neat to kind of connect with someone. So.
Yeah, and see if she has any sort of recommendations for your advice coming out of out of STEM, out of Berkeley. And recent experiences to tell you what to expect.
That would probably be good, because anyway, I already feel like I shouldn't have gotten in, and I'm just like, okay, well, so I'm going to just spend a lot of time just reviewing everything this summer. Like I really like LaTeX, so I'm going to like combine my two skills. So I'm going to write these like really beautiful review sheets in LaTeX for like not every class, but like the really relevant ones. Like I'm going to do it for this class, and I'm going to do it for differential equations.
Dude, you have a pen in your hand. Just use the pen.
No,
give yourself the time.
I will show you in lab how beautiful. I've written one, and
I'm sure they're extraordinary, but they also take a lot of time.
Yeah, but it's time you get to kind of like mull over it, you know?
All right.
Like,
all right.
Also, when you write something in text like that, you also want to say it as precisely as possible, and you kind of clarify like relaxations in speech that technically make things wrong, you know? And so I kind of like that, because even just writing it for like general chemistry, because I did it for all that, like, I learned so many like fine points about MO, because I was trying to write a sentence and I was like, well, maybe that's not right. And it wasn't.
Right.
So yeah,
I can see that.
I get what you mean.
Don't worry about imposter syndrome either. If you got into Berkeley, you deserve to get into Berkeley.
Hell yes.
And also I'll underscore what Jason was saying. And it's the same thing I told my sister, because she went to Berkeley. It's don't be afraid of your professors. Like, you deserve to be there and they want to talk to you.
Okay. Yeah. That was like, I was nervous, because I know I ask a lot of questions and I don't want to like go, you know, like I'm fine with annoying you, Jason. That's fine. Like, you know, but I don't want to annoy someone who's going to like get upset at me or something like that. Maybe.
No, you know, they're all people. And when you're asking questions about something that they're interested in, they're going to be happy to answer you. And so, don't get too caught up in, you know, the academic brain that they've got and how amazing they are. And
well, it's more just that you're like super approachable, because I mean, like,
yeah,
you have a PhD and stuff and you went through all that, but like, I don't know, you go to lengths to make yourself approachable.
Yeah, I try not to hang that PhD out there unless I need it for something.
Yeah.
it'll bite you in the ass though if you don't talk to them.
Yeah.
Like my sister got really intimidated because they're all like Berkeley professors. And then when she was trying to get into grad school, she had a really hard time trying to find reference letters because none of them knew who she was.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know,
that's right. That's true.
I'll make this connection. I'm pretty personable. So I you know, I'll make my way slowly.
You are. You've got that.
See?
Not a problem.
But I'll see you guys in lab in an hour. I want to like look over some mechanisms because I have some hydroboration oxidation questions.
Okay. Sounds good.
Sounds good. Okay. I'll see you guys in a little.
Bye. All guys. Right.
Bye-bye. You were reminding me of how I found my undergrad mentors, and I was laughing because they're so horrible mentors.
They're horrible mentors?
Well, I met most of them just because I'm a smoker, and then the only professor that ever specifically asked to be my mentor was the same person in my thesis orals who gave me all zeros because he got in a fight with the other professors on the panel.
Oh,
and then really? He's like, no, I really think that you're very skilled. I just gave all zeros because I don't believe in grading. I was like, you fucking, I told him,
yeah,
my bad. I was like, you're a fucking asshole, Howard.
And I like screamed at him, and he's like, no, I want to mentor you. And I was like, you can fucking mentor my ass.
That's just brutal. That's brutal. Yeah. When I did second year seminar, my professor and one of the other professors had gotten into some tiff, and Phil busted my ass in that second year seminar with all kinds of questions. But it was not as bad. What was even worse was I was at an ACS seminar. I was at a conference, an ACS conference, American Chemical Society conference. I was presenting. And I was presenting because my research advisor, the grad student who had done this work, had already graduated, and my professor wanted this work presented. And so he asked me to present it because I was the most, I was the best in front of an audience. I was the best able to do that with research that wasn't my own. And so he asked me to do that. And sitting in the front row was a professor who was a colleague of my professor. But they, not that they didn't get along, they were actually really good friends, but he liked to torture graduate students. Mm-hmm. And he liked to torture my professor's graduate students. And I had no idea who he was. And he just drilled me and made me look like an idiot in front of like a national conference in a room full of 60 people. And I didn't find out later, you know, until later who he was and what was going on. But man, I was sweating. It was just miserable. Anyway.
These are good stories to maybe not tell.
I'm sorry, Bibi, what was that real quick?
Oh, those are good stories to not tell them going into.
I know. Yeah, not give them those stories. Okay, I got to run and drive my wife to go pick up her car, and then I will be back at 3:00 and be back online with us.
Thank you so much for everything.
You're welcome. All right, take care. I'll see you soon. Bye.